yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. I'm going solo again today, and we're going to pick up where we left off. Still a few things to say about the shadow banking system here globally. And then I want to go into some depth talking about the recent release last week of U.S. GDP numbers for the first quarter of this year, 2014, in which everyone got surprised, a -2.9% drop in GDP. Well, that was pretty significant. And official estimators, or guesstimators, they're beginning to appear, of GDP were way off the mark. Way off the mark. At first, in the first release of GDP, you know, GDP, quarterly GDP has three releases. You have your preliminary numbers that come out right away after the end of the quarter. Then you have a first revision a month later, and then another revision after that. And the first estimate, provisional estimate, was 0.1% growth in the first quarter of this year's GDP, U.S. GDP numbers. Okay, looks pretty bad, looks stagnated, right? Well, then the first revision that came out in April showed, well, actually a contraction, a -1% growth in GDP. But then, last week, when we held the final third revision, what did we get? A -2.9%. Well, that may not sound like much, the number, but actually that was the average quarterly drop in GDP during the 2007-09 recession. If you average it out, what, you know, certain quarters, fourth quarter of 2008, first quarter of 2009, it was much greater, but it was less in the other quarters of that period, but they average out to 2.9% contraction. Okay, this raises the question, is that a signal of another recession coming? Well, that's one extreme you could interpret, but the other extreme is what these same forecasters who have missed that 2.9% by a mile are now saying, well, gee, you know, that don't be concerned, because it's going to be a 4 to 5% GDP growth in the current quarter and the rest of the year. I call these folks the Pollyannas of prediction, because they're so far off all the time, it seems, increasingly nowadays. But that's mainstream economics and the mainstream business press. So we will get back to the GDP forecast and what's behind it. And is this a recession coming? Is this, oh no, an aberration, and we are going to have a big V-shaped snapback, 4 to 5%. We've never hit 4 to 5% in any quarter since the 2009 recession ended. Okay, so is it going to be a V-shape now, big snapback that they're predicting? Or is it stagnation? In other words, stagnation would be we had a 2.9% big drop, and we will get a very tepid 1 to 2% recovery here in the second quarter. In other words, a stop-go, a bouncing along the bottom. Some quarters we get 3% growth, you know. Other quarters we get 3% decline. In between we get 2% and stagnation, so forth. Well, we'll get back to that. Is it recession? Is it stagnation? Is it, just an interim to a big recovery coming? Which one is it? We'll talk about that in the second half of the show. I want to shift, however, to discuss once again the shadow banking system. If you recall, last week's show, and you can listen to it on the archive, was stimulated, in my mind, by a report coming out of the Bank of England and its chairman, Mark Carney, who had a lead article in the global financial periodical, the Financial Times, that set off a series of feature stories and analyses of the shadow banking system globally in the Financial Times. And the theme there was pretty much, gee, we better do something about regulating these shadow banks. We're talking a lot about, we, meaning the finance capitalists and their policymakers, are talking a lot about regulating the traditional banks, but they're becoming aware that the shadow banks are even bigger in terms of total assets and their influence on the global banking system, global financial system, than the traditional banks are. And they're not being regulated much, if at all. Oh, so they're raising the flag. Central bankers around the world are raising the flag. Gee, we better do something about the shadow banking system and regulating it, or, you know, we could have another crash down the road, which I believe is coming in 2 to 5 years, maybe even earlier. You don't know. Things could really go wrong in China, where the shadow banking system has been growing so much faster than the traditional banking system. And we'll talk a little bit about that here and shortly when we talk about shadow banks in practice. So let's regulate these guys, they're saying, and they're talking about ways to regulate them, central banks regulate, because that's one of the tasks, you know, of central banks, is to not only provide money supply, not only to ensure lender of last resort for banks that are in trouble, but to supervise and regulate the banks so they don't engage in this super risky type of activity that they periodically do that leads to financial crashes, that leads to contractions of the real economy that we've seen here that can't really hasn't been able really to recover in any robust way since 2009. Okay, so they're talking about how do we regulate. And they really have no answer to that. They really have no answer to regulating the traditional banks. Once again, for purposes of discussion, for those who have just come on, didn't listen to last week, what do we mean by a shadow bank? Well, shadow banks are sometimes called financial intermediaries. They're basically not regulated, unlike traditional banks. Traditional banks would be your commercial banks, JP Morgan, Wells, Barclays, you know, banks like that. And the shadow banks are institutions like hedge funds, private equity firms, insurance companies, mutual funds, money market funds, private asset companies, finance companies, investment banks, broker dealers, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And they are outside the regulatory system. Right? Last week, I won't go over the figures again, but I showed how the shadow banking system, since 2008, is growing even faster in terms of assets and therefore influence, investable assets over the global economy, because this is a global phenomenon. This is not just in the U.S., although this shadow banking development occurred more aggressively and more quickly within the U.S. and England, Britain. It's a kind of a Anglo-American invention, you might say, which goes back several decades. It's not something that just occurred. They've been building since at least the 1960s these shadow banking institutions once again. And what are the problems with the shadow banks? Well, they're not regulated, right? Therefore, not being regulated, they take excessive risks, and when these markets, financial markets, contract, financial risks in good times mean great excessive profits, in bad times great excessive losses. And because they are connected to the traditional banking system, as we saw in the last crisis, when they crash, they pull down the traditional banking system, which then freezes up, does not make loans and provide money to non-bank companies, which then experience significant problems and frees up the rest of the real economy, and massive layoffs occur, and defaults and contraction occurs in the real economy, and down we go. Okay, that's what happened in 2007-9, and of course it's happened many times before, many, many times in U.S. history and global history. Other problems with shadow banks is that their activities tend to be opaque. In other words, it's hard for regulators and supervising central banks to know what the hell they're doing. Are they excessively taking risks and so forth? And that's a characteristic, opacity. They tend to engage in short-term investing and short-term borrowing and lending. They go after investments that are very liquid and therefore price volatile. In other words, short-term investing in asset price bubbles of various kinds. They look for liquid financial markets, which have really proliferated in recent decades around the world. They tend to be very highly leveraged. In other words, borrow a lot of money to invest even more, a little bit of their money, and borrow a lot more other money, in doing so, leverage and debt increases and drives up the cost, the price of the assets even more. Securitization is a way of increasing leverage. That's where you take a financial asset, you bundle it with others, and you call it something else, and you mark it up, and you resell that. So you're selling on top of selling of these financial assets. And of course, you're borrowing all the way, and debt is rising all the way. And then what we have is called covenants. Covenants are requirements for paying back the loans, and that weakens as well, and therefore becomes even more financially unstable, the loans and the debts and so forth. So these are all characteristics of shadow banks, and of course they are tied to the traditional banks who, in times of near crisis, approaching crisis, begin to act themselves like shadow banks. The lines blur. They loan money back and forth between each other. In the last crisis, the traditional banks set up their own hedge funds and so forth, right? Hedge funds, equity firms, mutual funds, all these kinds of players are now much, much larger than they ever been before. And the important thing is the shadow banking system has significantly expanded since the last crisis. Since the last crisis. Important development. In other words, they're beginning to run amok again. And as the as policymakers focus, central bankers focus on regulating traditional banks, the shadow banks are kind of falling through the loophole again. And that's what that Mark Carney article was all about. And by the way, the U.S. Federal Reserve, at the end of last year, also issued a report that, oh, we got to do something about regulating these guys or we're going to be in trouble again. You know, it's ironic, too, that the very, very low interest rates of the last 5 years, and, you know, near 1% or below interest rates that the central banks have been pumping into the regular banking system through zero interest loans, okay, and the QE, quantitative easing, where central banks go out and buy the bad assets that had imploded from investors during the speculative boom. In other words, it's a subsidy, it's a direct subsidy, trillions of dollars. This is called QE, quantitative easing. That injection of massive amount of money into the system, right, lowers interest rates very low, and that actually stimulates more speculative activity on the part of shadow banks and even banks. Well, how is that? Well, when interest rates are so very, very low, these institutions and investors borrow even more. They leverage even more on top of, you know, the investments they would have made, so they can have a larger position in their investment. And that larger position, you know, with the very low interest rates, will give them the high rate of return, absolute rate of return that they really want. So in other words, you've got to borrow a heck of a lot more in order to get the profits that you want. So the very low rates stimulate this borrowing, leveraging, And this crazy search for yield, as they call it, the desperate search for yield everywhere, is because they want to maintain their profit performance here, the managers of these shadow banks and other institutions. So they have to invest even more at the lower rate to get the same return. So lower rates, supposedly designed to bail out the banks, are at the same time creating a precondition where they become even more indebted than before, even more leveraged than before, thus even more fragile for the future. Fragility is really a term that I use, and others, to express a condition where an institution, it could be a bank, shadow bank, it could be a private corporation, it could be a government, becomes overextended in terms of debt, excess debt, thus you have to pay it back, right? Excess debt at a certain interest rate at a certain time, you got to pay back. Well, when you build up so much debt that has to be paid back, well, you got to generate a larger income stream to pay that debt. Make sure you pay that debt. And when there's a financial bubble that crashes, that income stream disappears, declines sharply. But the debt doesn't. The debt still has to be paid. And if your income stream is not large enough to pay the ever-growing debt, well, then you default on that debt. Not default simply means you don't pay the interest or principal or both. Oh, when that happens, then you really can't borrow anymore. No one's going to give you an additional loan anymore. That's exactly what happened with Bear Stearns Investment Bank and Lehman Brothers and Fannie Mae, all which collapsed in 2008, if you recall. Their income stream could not finance their huge debt load. No one would give them loans, and therefore they went bankrupt. Okay, so there's a relationship between debt and default, and also deflation, prices. When prices collapse, therefore your revenue collapses, and therefore you're not able to service your debt load. So deflation, debt, and default are all related, particularly in a crisis. Right? That's what I call in my book, Epic Recession 2010, the debt deflation default nexus. It's important to understand that relationship. And if you want to stop a financial crash, what you have to do is intervene in that nexus, in that process there, and stop the deflation, right? Backstop the defaults, right? And, or longer term, reduce the debt. One or all of those three things have to happen. And when you aren't able to stop that circular relationship between those three variables, then asset prices continue to fall and things get worse. Okay. So let's look at historically, shadow banks. Shadow banks have always existed and always been at the center of a financial crisis. And after the crisis, policymakers have tried to regulate the shadow banks. To some extent, they do so. But finance capital and capitalists and their money always find a way around the regulation. You cannot regulate them long term because money capital is like water flowing downhill. As I said last week, it will find a way around the regulatory dam eventually. And we see that historically in the U.S. Again, in my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Depression, in 2010, I have a chapter there, 5, which looks at what happened in the 19th century in the U.S. Three great depressions, at the center of which was a financial crash, 1830s, 1870s, 1890s, and at the center of which were shadow banks, creating financial vehicles and speculation. And often it's speculation in real estate or in other financial securities. But real estate was very typical in the U.S. in the 19th century. In the 1830s, it was a canal building and overinvestment and borrowing and debt in canals in the 1820s and 30s that led to the crash. And by the way, local governments were directly involved in all that, and states went bankrupt as well, defaulted in the 1830s as a result of this crash that was precipitated by the financial system. You see, the financial crash precipitates the more fundamental economic contraction that deeply follows it. And then because you have a banking system that's not able to resurrect the real economy, it goes on for quite some time. This is an interesting and important. The roles of the state in the 1830s crash in the U.S. Has some eerie similarities to what's going on in China right now, where you have local governments and local regions and provinces and cities that are heavily involved in borrowing from global financial shadow banks right now, fueling the property bubbles, both commercial and residential, that have been going on in Japan. I'm not just going to say in Japan, in China right now. We'll come back to that and the similarities and how large this shadow bank finance bubble going on in China really is. And the Chinese authorities, of course, are trying desperately to get their hands around this thing and trying to tame it with some little success, but clearly haven't been really able to bring that the shadow banks to heel in China. And we'll talk about the excess debt buildup that's going on there. Okay, so in the 1870s and 1890s in the U.S., we had other similar second, third big depressions. And at the center of this, again, was speculating by shadow banks and investors, very, very wealthy investors, in financial securities. Then it was, in the 1870s, it was railroad bonds that caused the crash of 1872. And in the 1890s, it was the trusts, and again, railroad bonds and other securities like Tontine Insurance and stock holding companies and so forth, right? And then in 1907, it was once again the trusts who that had recovered and speculating in commodities. Copper, of course, was the big commodity in those days because we had electrification going on and you need copper for electricity. So the trust attempted to overinvest. They overinvested in copper. They crashed and because they were tied to the traditional banks, they dragged down the traditional banks. There was a run on all the banks and we had a big financial crash in 1907. The banks got bailed out by the U.S. Treasury, but the arrested economy did not. Sound familiar? Yes. And the economy bounced along the bottom for 7 years until World War One broke out and fiscal spending in the U.S. then re-stimulated the economy. But during that seven-year period from 1907 to 13, there were two double-dip recessions that followed because the real economy just really couldn't get going. Right? And then, of course, we have 2013, 14 now, in the U.S., and what do we see in terms of speculation? What's going on? Well, we have a repeat going on in some ways. Of course, everyone knows the 2007-08 crash was closely related to subprime mortgage bonds of financial security, and it was driven up by what's called securitizing those bonds, taking those mortgage bonds and mixing them with collateralized debt obligations, CDOs and ABSs, asset-backed securities, and then credit default swaps on top of them and so forth. And when those bonds at the heart of all these derivative instruments collapsed, well, it brought down the rest of all these instruments held in different places by shadow banks of various kinds and shadow institutions, structured investment vehicles, and so forth, of the real traditional banks. You know, they're kind of de facto investment vehicles off books. We know that whole story, right? But what's happening now? Well, we're seeing a return in some ways of that kind of activity. If you look at the collateralized loan obligations and leveraged loans going on. A huge increase in these since 2007. 2007, which was the boom year, leveraged loans, loan obligations at 0.6 trillion, 600 billion. Okay. Well, over the last several years, leveraged loans have increased a total of new issues of 3 trillion. So CLOs and leveraged loans, auto loans. Now, what do you think the auto industry is doing so, quote, well, qualified well for the last couple of years? Well, that's because the auto companies are providing really attractive lending to purchase their cars. Really attractive, you know, like 4 years, 0, 0, 0, whatever. And they're all competing with each other. And actually, except for luxury cars, prices haven't risen that much. And the terms of financing of auto loans are very, very attractive. Well, why are they doing this? Aren't they losing money on this? Well, what's happening is, just as with housing and subprime mortgages, we got subprime auto loans now. The auto companies are reselling these loans. They're not holding on to them. They're selling them to investors. Securitization is what it's called. And we have all kinds of derivatives going on and all kinds of speculative practices. You may have read them: dark pools, fast trading, crowdfunding, right? Bitcoins even are an example of excess liquidity. People don't know what to do with it, so they are buying bitcoins. It's a pure speculative play. They create a new financial instrument. Bitcoins are nothing but a new financial instrument, and people are speculating with it. You know, I call them digital tulips. You know, the tulip mania in Holland in the 1600s, where everyone was buying tulips because the price of tulips were rising. They weren't buying tulips because they like flowers. They bought the tulips because they thought the next day they'd be able to sell it for even more. Tulip mania. And, of course, that drove the price of tulips up, up, and up as everyone was trying to buy them. But at a certain point, the price collapsed, and then everyone couldn't sell their tulips, and they lost all their investment in tulips. Well, bitcoins, I think, are kind of like the same thing going on. There's more to it than that, because bitcoins are also used for transactions, and they are a kind of alternative currency. So it's not a pure speculative play, but that speculative element is an important part of it all. We'll talk about bitcoins in a future show. But we have junk bonds, corporate junk bonds that have gone through the roof here. We have speculation in foreign exchange trading. We got all this manipulation of LIBOR and global bank interest rates. You know, it's all going on again. What are at the center of it? What shadow banks? Well, hedge funds, mutual funds, real estate investment trusts, insurance companies, and so forth. It's, you know, it's back to the same thing in different form. Different securities, different shadow institutions, different forms, but it's all going on. Once again, and it's similar in some ways, you know, to the 2007-2008 crash, and this rush towards searching for a yield, this frantic search to maintain high yield, is pushing particularly shadow banks into more and more risky investments. And again, the very low interest rates, as I said, from the central bank, designed to provide cheap liquidity to financial institutions to bail them out, fill up the black hole in their balance sheet from the crash, right, is now ironically pushing them to more speculative, desperate search for yield because rates are so low, which drives them to more and more debt and borrowing in order to get their returns, right? Also, it's interesting that as traditional banks are getting squeezed by their competition in the shadow banks, right, which is happening, attempts to regulate the traditional banks by forcing them to keep more capital, i.e. cash on hand, in the event of another crash, is dampening the profitability of these traditional banks. And as a result, they cannot take as much risky investment as they used to. And the investors themselves are leaving the traditional banks. I'm talking about wealthy investors, high net worth individuals, and turning to the shadow banks. which requires the traditional banks to borrow more from the shadow banks, in which, you know, once again, the problem becomes more apparent and more complex once again. Okay, so ironically, contradictions here. The bailing out, central bank bailing out of the banking system is actually creating the preconditions for a new crisis. Now, last week I said you got to understand that the problem is not just debt. Debt is the manifestation of the greater problem, which is excess liquidity. Ever since World War II, central banks led by the U.S., because the dollar is the center of the global financial currency system, ever since the late 1940s, the central bank has been pumping money into the system more and more for a whole host of reasons, to maintain the empire, to finance U.S. foreign direct investment around the world, to re-stimulate the economy every time we have a recession, and then massive liquidity injections to bail out the banks as financial instability over the decades has grown more and more, and bailouts are more frequent and bigger and longer. So the Federal Reserve, the dollar, is being pumped into the global economy in massive amounts over decades. And it was that pumping by the late 1960s that created euro-dollar markets and these other financial markets around the world. And because the U.S. was still on the Bretton Woods system, where it would exchange gold for dollars, as more and more liquidity dollars built up around the world, and countries, particularly in Europe, said, well, we want to cash it in for gold, the U.S. in the early 1970s went off the gold standard, well, the quasi-gold standard, the dollar gold standard. And ever since then, the only way that countries can maintain stability in their currency is to pump more money periodically into the global economy to buy and sell their currency to keep it stable. So ever since the crash with the Smithsonian Agreement in the 1970s and the crash of the Bretton Woods Agreement in the 1970s, banks have been pumping money in to keep their currency stable. And it's not just the dollar, but to some extent it's the British pound and now the euro since 1999. And increasingly it will be the Chinese yuan. So, but overwhelmingly, it's the dollar. Overwhelmingly, and still, it's the dollar that is the source of this big global liquidity explosion. And when you have so much liquidity around the world, and in the 1980s, what happened? We eliminated the flow on capital. Money capital flow controls were eliminated by the U.S. and elsewhere very rapidly. So all this huge money liquidity explosion starts sloshing around the world. And an excess of it develops, and it develops in the hands of the very high net worth individuals, you know, the big finance capitalists, and their institutions, but individuals as well. And with all that excess money, it's more than they can invest in real asset development, except for places like, you know, emerging markets. Some of it goes there, but a lot of the excess goes into playing around with financial securities as a way of investing and making money, financial security investment. So they create their institutions. The shadow banks proliferate from the 1980s on as institutions that will find ways of taking the money of the ultra-super-rich, mega-rich, ultra-high-net-worth, and super-high-net-worth individuals and invest it in these liquid financial markets. And even that is not sufficient from time to time, so it gets hoarded. Huge amounts of cash hoarded there on the sidelines, and mainstream economists are saying, well, it's going to come off the sidelines here. You know, we've got to figure a way to get them to corporations sitting on trillions of dollars and individuals sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars, right? In fact, if you look at the individuals behind the shadow banks, the new financial, global financial elite, since 2008, this 42, 45 trillion dollars, up from 28 trillion in the crash. Ultra high net worth individuals, in other words, people who have more than $30 million a year in investable assets. I'm not talking about their property, their real property, you know, their homes or the businesses, the value of, you know, the buildings and so forth. I'm talking about liquid investable property. $30 million a year they generate from their investments. And these are called ultra high net worth individuals, about 200,000 of them around the world. You can go down a little bit and talk about very high net worth individuals. Those are folks with 5 to 30 million a year of investable assets. And, you know, it's projected there we're looking at $50 trillion in the hands of these investors. Now, their shadow banks are their preferred investment vehicles. They've created more of them to find a way to invest all this liquidity and all these financial assets. So there's a linkage here between the institutions, the shadow banks, the ultra-high net worth investors who are the big investors in the shadow banks, and the creation of all these financial instruments in order to buy and sell and trade them. All three go together, right? But the roots of this go back to the elimination of international capital flows and the collapse of the Bretton Woods system and the pumping of even more decade after decade of liquidity into the system. So the problem is really begins with excess liquidity. And that leads to debt, taking on debt, and that leads to ever-increasing desperate search for yield, and that leads to bailouts and low interest rates, which stimulate the search for yield even more, and on we go, over and over. So let's look at China, right? China itself is shadow banking boom and bust going on in China. Again, remember, an indicator is excess debt, and often in local real estate. Well, if you look at China, there's an explosion of what's called local government financial vehicles going on, LGFVs, and trust products, trusts, trust institutions and trust products. That has grown $4.8 trillion. The assets in these trust products that invest in local construction, residential construction, business, commercial construction, local industry, and so forth. A lot of it, investment is going on by municipalities and regional provinces and so forth, not investment driven by the central bank of China, but local. And the money flowing in from the global shadow banks is financing this, and now there's $4.8 trillion. In these trust products in China. China's total debt over the last 6 years has risen 87%. That compares to U.S. total debt between 2002 and 2007 before the crash here, 41%. 87%. Huge debt buildup, and most of it is this local government debt fueled by the shadow banks. And shadow banks, of course, speculating in Chinese currency because it was rising for most of the last year, several years. So it's a guaranteed speculating in the yuan, speculating in local government investment and debt. And the Chinese government and the central government has been trying to get a handle on this. Last year, they tried to do it by raising interest rates, which slowed down the rest of their economy. Did not work. They had to turn around and reboost the economy. And this year, they're also taking on the shadow banks, trying to, and the economy is slowing once again. And now they have a mini-stimulus, too. So they're going back and forth between attempting to contract money and speculation in the economy, and at the same time trying not to slow down the economy. But we have a general long-run slowdown going on in China as a result. Okay, so we have a growing problem of shadow banks and speculators, ultra-high net worth individuals, and speculating in new financial instruments in China, local government, and housing and construction and building and so forth. And there are signs that This thing is beginning to lead to defaults in some areas in China, corporate defaults, particularly in older industries, and the central bank and the central Chinese government authority is having to start bailing out some of these financial instruments and so forth. We will see whether this intensification will occur in the China banking system, but it is a danger spot. Another example of where we see shadow banks wrecking their, doing their damage, of course, is in Argentina right now. Big fight going on between Argentina government paying off hedge funds who speculated in the worst times of Argentina's debt run-up here a decade or so ago. We'll talk about that some other time in detail. But the recovery of bonds, investing in bonds, periphery, government periphery bonds and junk bonds in Europe, the southern periphery, southern Europe, that's and, of course, speculating in Greek bonds in the last couple years, making you know, the Greek debt even worse, government debt even worse. Hedge funds and others, equity, were at the forefront of that deterioration. Wherever you see these government financial crises, you know the hedge funds and other shadow banks were involved, driving up bond yields and so forth by their investments. So they destabilize in many ways the rest of the global economy here and there, and they're going to be at the heart of the problems in the Ukraine here soon. Okay, so that's the you know, the shadow bank. We could talk more about it, but in my forthcoming book, Transitions to Global Depression, I will be writing quite a bit upon you know, that topic of the growing problem of shadow banks, which is the problem of finance capital and finance capitalists. The important thing to remember is that these aren't, it isn't the market that is the problem here. It isn't even these institutions, but behind these institutions are the new financial global elite, and that's what we mean by the ultra-high net worth individual investors behind the picture that are really the source of the instability that's growing on. And it's because there's too much liquidity and money flows too quickly across the globe, now electronically enabled by technology, and that fact, the vast excess liquidity and this vast growth that's going on even as we talk here, and the fact that these financial elite are really internationalists, globalists, and they don't really care about one country or the other. They live in all of them and have investment in all of them. That's going to make it extremely difficult for central banks, Mark Carney and Janet Yellen in the U.S. and others, to try to get a handle, a regulatory handle on these folks. Again, money capital in a global capitalist system will always find a way downhill, and it will get around the regulatory apparatus, which doesn't even exist for the shadow banks, you might say. It exists weakly for traditional banks, but hardly exists at all for shadow banks, and all this debt and excess liquidity is, and search for yield and risky investing is going on again. But the centerpiece is the shadow banking system. That's where you got to look for the next crisis. Okay. Now I want to switch and talk about the first quarter U.S. GDP numbers. I've been talking and writing about GDP for 18 months now and questioning a lot of the forecasts for U.S. Gross domestic product here, where it was going. You can read some of my prior articles on my blog, jackrasmus.com, or on my website, Kiklos Productions. Most recently here, a few weeks ago, earlier in June, a piece called The Real, Real GDP. And before that, a piece that I wrote last November, when we had another apparently surge in GDP, third quarter of 2013, and I wrote a piece called False Positives, Analyzing Recent U.S. GDP Reports. That's November 11th, 2013. And the most recent here, the real GDP, is June 3rd, 2014. And now I just produced an article that will go up today that appeared on blogs yesterday called U.S. GDP Drops -2.9%, Recession or Stagnation Ahead. Now, you got to remember that mainstream economists and government and the business press are all hyping and have been hyping for several years now that, oh, big recovery around the corner, big recovery around the corner. Every time we get a decline, a quarterly decline in GDP or a stagnation in GDP, what you get from them is, oh, it's winter weather, you know, the weather metaphor. Now, if you look at U.S. GDP performance here since the end, official declared end of the recession in June 2009, we had a contraction before. We had a contraction in first quarter of 2011. It actually declined, the U.S. economy, GDP. And then we had another one in the fourth quarter of 2012. That was adjusted up into a minor 0.4 growth, but initially it was a contraction. And now we have the first quarter 2014. So since the so-called end of the last recession, we've had three contractions. Now, they've only been a quarter long in terms of duration. That's what I call an economic relapse. It's the concept that I use. Relapse meaning a short, shallow decline followed by a short, shallow recovery. And then you go a little way below par economic recovery, and then you have another short, shallow stagnation or decline. This is kind of a stop-go recovery, I call it, bouncing along the bottom. I very much like what happened between 1907 and 1914. Very, very much. Again, because the banks get bailed out, but the rest of the real economy does not really get stimulated. You don't really get investment, and that creates real jobs that then creates real disposable income growth and consumption, which is two-thirds of the economy, then drives the rest of the economy forward. That hasn't happened since 2007. For a number of reasons that we'll talk about. Well, the numbers that came out at the beginning of the year for first quarter GDP, as I said at the beginning of the show, showed a stagnation, a 0.1% growth. But then the adjusted numbers, first revision came out in April, showed a -1% drop, and then a -2.9% drop. But they're saying, oh, it's just the weather, you know, it's just the winter weather, and now we're going to have this big snapback, 4 to 5% growth. Well, it's not the weather. If you look at that 2.9%, it's really a 3% swing, isn't it? A swing from a 0.1% to a -2.9 is a 3% swing in these numbers, you know, which is really significant in itself, the swing, because we never had such a large adjustment in more than four decades. We've never seen such a large adjustment from the initial reporting on GDP to the significant contraction that gets reported at the end. Well, why is that? Well, you can't have that kind of a swing just due to weather. You know, you can't make that much of an error due to weather estimations. If you look at a closer composition of GDP in the first quarter and its magnitude, you know, what you see are some, and I've been talking about since last year, are going to be the real causes. I predicted last year that 2014 would see a contraction. Why? Because if you look at, go back to the third quarter of last year, and you look at GDP for that quarter, what you see was a 3% plus growth in GDP. And if you look at it closely, you will see that was mostly inventory investment buildup by businesses. In other words, businesses bought into the hype that now we're going to have a big fourth quarter holiday spending boom coming. recovery is really here. So they started building up their inventory in expectation of that happening. All the excess inventory then did not get sold off. The retail sales, consumer sales boom did not materialize at the end of last year. And businesses were holding all this excess inventory. The expectations, anticipations, the consumer surge did not materialize. And remember, the consumer is at the most important element in the economy. The consumer is at least two-thirds of the economy. And that did not occur. We did not see that happen. So business was stuck holding all this inventory. I predicted that's what was going to happen in my November article, based upon the evidence that came out from the third quarter GDP. If you look at it in detail, it was all largely inventory stimulated, and to some extent exports stimulated. And I predicted it would collapse back here in 2014, which of course it did. Right? And that was at the core of the decline in the first quarter. It was business inventory adjustments from this huge increase last year, reducing inventory. That accounted for 1.7% of the 2.9% contraction. Another element that I had predicted would weakening in the first quarter was U.S. net exports over imports, because the global economy was slowing down, so U.S. would export less, and therefore GDP would be less. Well, that was 1.5% of the 2.9%. So if you look at that, it's really significantly those two elements, not weather. Inventory adjustment has nothing to do with weather. You create the stuff, you book it, it doesn't have anything to do with, you got to ship it to a warehouse first before you can claim it as GDP. And, of course, the weather was blocking railroads, all that nonsense argument. No. And the same for net exports, right? Exports get produced, goods for sale, and, they get booked, and it doesn't matter when they get shipped. So both inventory adjustment and net exports over 3% of the decline in GDP during the first quarter. Nothing to do with weather. In addition, there was another problem that appeared, and that was Bureau of Economic Advisor estimators, or guesstimators, maybe I should call them now, were saying that, there was a big surge in consumer spending in the first quarter, 3.3%. That was because everyone was buying health care, Obamacare, right? ACA. Right? Now, you don't have to go anywhere to buy ACA. You do it online or you do it by phone. So, again, that couldn't have been affected by weather. And voila, it turned out that, that was an overestimation, that consumer spending, which produced offset these other declines in inventory and net exports, right, this huge increase that supposedly occurred in consumer spending that gave us net this 0.1% growth. Well, consumer spending actually turned out to be a negative one, not negative, but only 1%. Not 3.3, but only 1%. The big increase estimate from ACA did not actually occur. So you got to take down that offsetting consumer spending surge, and what do you get? You get 2.9% as a result. But the important point is none of this, the consumer spending stagnation going on, had anything to do with weather. If it had to do largely with ACA spending, right? And all these predictions now that, we're going to get a big snapback. Well, the slowdown continued into April in most of the indicators. And what has happened in April and May as far as consumer spending is concerned? Adjusted for inflation, it declined. Yes, consumer spending is still in the doldrums or weakening even more, and it's two-thirds of the economy. So where is this 4.5% snapback this quarter coming from if consumer spending, two-thirds of the economy, is turning negative in real terms? Where's it coming from? Maybe it's coming from housing, right? No. Housing is leveled off as well. You know, housing, the housing, quote, boom was really driven by very high-end institutional buying. Average people are not buying houses. There was median people in new families entering the job market are not making enough money. And the job creation to stimulate housing at the low end, new entrance into the housing market. So it's mostly high-end homes and wealthy homes and institutionals and offshore money that was for a while stimulating the housing market. But now the big bank mortgage companies, Wells and others, are laying off thousands of processors. They know that the housing, quote, recovery has stalled. They know that. Okay, so you're not going to see anything out of housing, just as it appears nothing's coming out of consumer and consumer spending. Of course, auto loans keep plodding along as better and better financing deals because of securitization keep pumping deals. You know, some credit card increase going on. People are taking on more and more credit card debt. Of course, they're dipping into the savings even more. Savings rates are now below 4% in the U.S. So the extent that you got any consumption going on, even when it's flat like it is now, from the bottom 90% households, it's debt-driven and savings drawdown-driven, which is not long-term. Because all this talk about jobs and job creation is a lot of nonsense in terms of income growth. Most of the jobs are low-wage jobs, a lot of them contingent part-time temp jobs, but not enough to really stimulate household spending significantly going forward. So all this talk about, well, it created 200,000 jobs, but look at the composition of those jobs. Not all that impressive in terms of income. Which I've talked about before. And now we're facing some headwinds, further consumer headwinds, with food price rises because of drought in the West, gasoline price rises because of problems occurring, you know, in the oil patches around the world with Iraq and other places. Healthcare inflation, as I reported in previous shows, health insurance companies are planning 8 to 22% premium increases here in this coming year. Education costs keep rising. So these headwinds, where is this consumer spending going to come from that will generate a 4 to 5% GDP snapback? Again, these Pollyannas of prediction have their heads in the sand or somewhere else that I won't mention, and it's just wishful thinking. You know, we're not going to see a 4 or 5% snapback. What we will see is, you know, maybe a 1 to 2% this quarter, next second half of the year. Who knows what that's going to be? You can't predict that right now. Things are too unstable, too volatile. The U.S. economy could actually weaken even more in the second half of the year. And I really don't see anywhere, any evidence of a huge increase that will generate a 4 to 5% GDP growth rate in the second half of the year. I don't see it with exports. U.S. dollar will continue rising in relationship to other currencies. So, you know, forget exports as a driven. We've talked about consumers. Business inventory spending will become much more cautious. So where's it going to come from? Government spending? I don't think so. Well, you get some government spending. Like we did in 2012 before that election that year, but it won't be enough. We're going to continue bouncing along the bottom, folks. You know, 1 to 2% growth period followed in terms by stagnation periodically and so forth. That's the long run picture. And that's because all the money capital, or much of the money capital, is flowing into financial speculation, being hoarded on corporate balance sheets, and by the very wealthy, or invested abroad, but not going to generate real jobs and real income and real recovery in the United States. So that's my take, and you can read that article on my blog and the others, jackrasmus.com. Okay, next week, we're going to come back and look at the immigration crisis once again, and all these poor kids trying to come across the border and what all that means. And immigration reform, which is now dead. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus. Alternative Visions, come back, and we'll talk some more going forward about the financial crisis that's coming again. 2 to 5 years.